This podcast is brought to you by Villanova University on iTunes U. Please visit us on itunes.villanova.edu.
So I wanted to sort of maybe start to get the conversation going with Joanne. And I wanted to sort of get very, very basic, right? Because democracy, we should probably have a working definition for that, at least in the American perspective, in the American perspective. You've done a lot of work on the Founding Fathers and the early Republic. By the way, she's involved with some musical about some early American Founding Father. You may have heard of it. It ran on Broadway for a little bit. But I wonder if you could maybe start by just kind of walking us through. Did the white men, and they were white men, who established this thing we call America, did they have a vision of democracy that they had in mind? What did democracy mean for them? Maybe that's a good starting point. And then I'll ask you to make sure the mic is on.
There we go. Perfect. Okay. Can folks hear me?
Yes.
Wonderful. When I teach about the Revolution and the early Republic at Yale, one of the things that I always warn my undergraduates against is what I call democracy speak. Because I think students assume, and many Americans assume as well, you know, democracy is good. Democracy has always been good. The founders loved democracy. You can sort of see the list of things that everyone assumes. But actually, in the founding period, democracy as that generation understood it meant everyone participating in government in the sense of ancient Athens. That, in their mind, was not conceivable, was not practical. So you even have people like Thomas Jefferson, who nowadays we really, in some ways, see as this great champion of democracy. You can see him in early periods saying, we're not doing democracy. We're making a republic, but we're not creating a democracy. So it was the process of representation that they felt was going to ground things. Now there was a, I'd say there was a spectrum of ideas about democracy being good or bad. I would say Alexander Hamilton, who I indeed have studied for a very long time, and no one knew who he was. For 35 years, no one knew who he was. I would say in the spectrum of views about democracy, he was over on one side with a great deal of distrust in the process of democracy. He didn't believe that the body politic was responsible and capable of coming together and sort of making wise decisions. He spent most of his political career trying to centralize government, trying to ensure that power holders had the kind of power he thought that they should have. And he's pretty consistent. There's a remarkable document right after the Federal Convention. He does something very lawyerly. He leaves the Federal Convention, he goes home, he sits down, and he writes basically a memo to himself. What do I think is going to happen next? And all through the convention, he was the guy saying, we need, you know, more than checks and balances, I don't know, the masses, you can't trust them. So this memo, he says, well, maybe Washington will become president, that would be great. He'll probably put good men in office and people will trust them, that would be great. And then he goes on the other side of the coin and says, well, maybe he won't be president, maybe he won't put good men in office. Probably in that case, the states would turn on each other, the people would turn against each other, maybe another nation would sweep in and swallow up parts of the United States and the whole thing would collapse. And the kicker in this is at the end, he says, of that latter sort of apocalyptic scenario, that's the most likely outcome. So he leaves the convention assuming that this experiment in democratic governance probably can't work. His last letter is a letter to a friend in which he says, be careful because democracy will destroy the republic. The worst thing that this republic has going for it is democracy. So that's one side of the spectrum. I'd say Jefferson is on the other side. Jefferson really did believe that people had a sort of inner guide that if they followed, they would choose correctly. So he had far more faith that things would go right in a democratic form of governance. And I'd say between the two is probably where a lot of the other founding generation met. But the important thing to take away from the founding period, I would say, is that they didn't necessarily trust it, they didn't necessarily like it, and I think probably one of the things we're going to be talking about is the ways in which the understanding and feelings about democracy are negotiated so aggressively over time.
And it seems to me that this feeds directly into their vision of who sort of should be making the decisions, right? So who would be entrusted to actually represent and make decisions on behalf of the country?
Absolutely. So their obviously their idea of democracy is not only that they're suspicious of it, but it's a very small group of people that they assume is going to really have any political clout. So it's men, white men who have a certain amount of economic clout, those are the people who should be making decisions. The degree to which they really, these elite white men, suspected they were dubious about allowing power to trickle down. There's a fellow in the late 1790s who I gather was not quite as elite as some of the other folks that were in the early Congress. I think his name was Swanwick. And when you read the letters of congressmen, they're stunned that someone as lowly as Swanwick could get into Congress. How did he get power? He does not deserve power. And I'm sure we're talking not huge amounts of difference. So they had a very small sort of ratio of people that they assumed were really going to have political power. I think they felt that they were being responsible to the greater whole, but they didn't trust that greater whole in any way to wield power.
Right. And I guess that was another question that I wanted to bring up for discussion. Was for our 21st century years, this sounds very anachronistic and kind of snobbish. But can we put ourselves in their shoes? What were they thinking? What was it that this was such a risky endeavor from their part that they just didn't want anyone to mess it up?
Well, for sure, it's worth thinking about where this American experiment is taking place. Right, this is a world of monarchies, and here's this little fly speck of a country that says, we're going to do something experimental. We're going to create a republic, a democratic republic. So there was no assumption, this is part of where Hamilton got a lot of his skepticism from, there was no assumption that that could work. There was no assumption, you can see that throughout the first 10, 15 years of governance. They constantly think that if they do one stupid decision, it's all going down. It's all going to tank. So it was exceedingly experimental. They assumed that all the time, and that sort of fed also into this distrust of trusting too many people and trusting power in the hands of too many people.
And, I did want to put on the table, too, how government actually operated in the early republic, because I think we look at Congress in Washington today and see dysfunction and bickering. And then I read your work, and I said, oh, actually, bickering and dysfunction has sort of been endemic to this institution since it was created.
It's true. It's true. A democratic republic, a republic grounded on representation, is always going to have the human dynamic at its heart. Even in this founding generation, when they believed that they themselves were somehow thinking of the greater good, Congress gets deadlocked. There's all kinds of bickering. My first book talks about nasty newspaper attacks and political gossip and everything else that they were throwing at each other. Partly out of desperation because they thought, well, I, of course, know what's right for this democratic republic, so I must destroy this other person who clearly cannot know. But so if you're talking about polarization, if you're talking about anger, if you're talking about pettiness, if you're talking about even violence, you can go all the way back to the beginning of the republic.
And your current book that just came out is about violence in Congress.
Correct. The book that literally only a few weeks ago came out is about physical violence in the U.S. Congress, I found about 70 previously undiscovered physical incidents like fistfights, knives and guns being pulled, mass brawls. And I look at, over time, what does that tell you about how Congress is functioning? What does that tell you about the nation? And how does that really show you the Union essentially working its way towards civil warfare? How do Americans learn to distrust each other? And the violence is bound up in that.
And so as a sort of a bridge to get into Allison and her work, do we have a sense about how the early founders in this early republic viewed those who were on the outside of the process? So were they supposed to just accept what the insiders came up with? Was there any honest way of getting sort of representation in any sort of form from that body politic and then having it funnel back to representatives and congressmen? congressman, or was it completely there on the outside wrong?
Well, I mean, they had their own defined version of the body politic, right? Which was other voting men, you know, white men. So they certainly felt that, and even someone like Hamilton, who doubted democracy so much, understood that at the core of this new experimental government was public opinion. They don't really know who the public is fully, and they don't know how to get public opinion. They talk about that all the time. But they understand that in some way or another, what they're doing in a different way from other governments is grounded on the public. They're constantly, you know, how do you figure out public opinion of the government? You know, Washington says, you, my friend, go ride around and sit in taverns and listen to what people say and then report back to me. Do they like the government? How do you figure that out? But they certainly did have an assumption that people who were not quite of their class and who were white and male would also, they were the foundation of the republic.
Is it ironic that someone as suspicious as Hamilton was of democracy is so lauded because of this musical, and yet someone like Burr, who was more of an advocate for sort of what we've envisioned as democracy, is sort of demonized?
Oh no, this is the weirdest thing in the universe. So I've been studying Hamilton for 35 years before this point. And in all of that time, either people didn't know who he was or they thought he was the great villain of American history, right? This aristocratic sort of evil guy. And I kept saying to people when I would be lecturing about him, well, he's someone that deserves to be in the circle of founders. You know, he played a role. Let's talk about what that role is. He's worth noticing. And now I just wander around saying, he's not so great. So yeah, it's weird that that's happening, and it's weird that he's being adored as a kind of democratic founder in a way that he wouldn't even have liked.
Right. I think we can get back to some of that in the conversation, and perhaps the audience has some ideas on that as well. But it's a good pivot, I think, to Allison and your work, because obviously this early version of the Republic, this early democracy, excludes a lot of people who are in the United States, and particularly excludes African Americans and enslaved peoples. From your work, from your teaching and research, do we have a sense about how African Americans in the early Republic and into the 19th century viewed democracy? Did they talk and write about this?
Indeed they do. I think the challenge that we have is we assume that everyone is enslaved, or that they're free and illiterate, and therefore they are outside of the process of democracy. But as I say to my students when I teach the Civil War and afterwards, my focus is on Reconstruction, when Mary Chestnut writes in her diary that she is shocked that her slaves understand exactly where the Yankees are, why they're coming, and that they are fleeing to the Yankees, she is shocked and appalled. I held these people to my bosom. I thought they loved me. In fact, they are not they're not the least bit interested in her feelings. But they're very aware of what's happening around them. And they know where the Yankees are because they're serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner as whites sit and talk about what's in the newspaper and where the Yankees are. Right. So that is sort of the stance of black people in the period of the early Republic and afterwards. They exist in the world. I reject the idea that people of African descent are pre-political in this moment. Certainly for people who are free, who are living in the North that is slowly trudging its way toward emancipation, as slowly as they possibly can, black people are, as early as 1777, writing the Massachusetts House and saying, we, your slave brethren, also wish to be free. Right? We have black people actually voting in some states because they are not citizens of the entire republic, but they are citizens of those individual states. And we see New York grant black people the right to vote, then take it back, then grant them the right to vote again with property restrictions. Pennsylvania allows black people to vote because the literature of the Constitution simply says a freeman. And so blacks who have gotten their freedom say, that's us, we're free, we can vote, right? And then in 1838, the Pennsylvania state constitution changes and they substitute white or put white in front of Friedman, taking that right away. But what that means in the interim is that people of African descent have been involved in this democratic process for two very good reasons. The first is, if you have been freed, you understand that most of your brethren are not. And so they're interested in politics, they're interested in democracy, because they want to push the nation toward abolition, right? Philadelphia's own Richard Allen, when he writes the eulogy for Washington, right, says, we participate in common, right? We too are part of this democratic republic. And the idea is to convince your democratic fellows that there is something deeply morally wrong and undemocratic about holding people as slaves. So they're trying to win freedom for their brethren. They are also aware of what it is, as contemporary people are aware, what it is to live in a democracy without a status of citizenship. So they're very interested in democracy, and they are constantly pushing state after state after state to be recognized as citizens in their state.
It's interesting, because one of the questions that sparks in me is, was there a real belief that democratic politics could solve big problems like abolition and freedom?
Yes, actually. Again, to go back to Allen, Andrich Newman does a wonderful job in his biography of Richard Allen. He says, you know, this guy has learned to work very, very hard under desperate circumstances in order to win his own freedom. And he will take that work ethic into everything he does the rest of his life. And he is convinced in the beginning of his young adulthood that through religion and through politics, he can convince his white brethren that black people are also the children of Christ and also fellow citizens. And that is the beginning of what's going to move us toward abolition. Unfortunately, Allen's optimism is perhaps misplaced. His fellow Americans are not as big-hearted and as committed to the equality of all men in Christ as they say they are on Sunday morning. So that by the end of his life, he is less convinced that America is the promised land and that government would solve this problem, and has entertained the conversation about going to what is the only black republic in the world, which is Haiti, for black people, and if not Haiti, Canada, right? But he gives it the old school try for many, many years, as do many other black abolitionists.
And it strikes me too, as we talk about different perspectives on democracy, right? Democracy in this period for African Americans probably looks different from state to state, from parts of state to parts of state.
Exactly. So again, you could vote in Pennsylvania, but you could vote in Pennsylvania in the county around Philadelphia. It's a little different as you went farther west, right? You could vote in New York City with relative ease, but moving outside of that county, it gets a little harder, right? It requires that your fellow citizens recognize you as someone who has the legitimacy of coming to a polling space, right? It goes back and forth, and what we see toward the tail end of the period of the early republic, between 1814 and 1838, is this closing of the window of opportunity. So democratic opportunities for African Americans in terms of participating as citizens gets narrower and narrower, right? So when blacks lose their right to vote in Pennsylvania in 1838, that will be the case until after the American Civil War.
Right. And I did want to talk a little bit about the post-Civil War period. I know some of your work specifically looks at that era. And I was struck in some of your work about the notion of this eagerness among African Americans to participate in democratic structures once emancipation was delivered. And this notion of sort of learning to be a citizen, learning what the expectations are, learning the Constitution, learning about the workings of government, learning how to vote. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. The thing that struck me most in doing the work on the Georgia Freedmen in the Low Country is how many of the people who show up as a political voice immediately after the Civil War had been soldiers. Many of them, of the group that I'm looking at, the USCT 33rd, had been enslaved right there in the Low Country. They run to the Union Army and sign up. The first thing they do besides learning how to drill is they learn how to read from someone. All it takes is one man in a unit, and that whole unit will master literacy. The things that they learn from are newspapers, but also the Bible. And there's this running conversation throughout the Civil War about rights, about states, about the duties and responsibilities of citizenship. So when Field Order 15 happens, that's the legendary 40 acres and a mule. It happens literally because Sherman speaks to a group of black ministers and says, what is it that you need to be free? And they're very straightforward with him. They say, we need access to land, to hoe and to till and to make it our own. That will allow us to be independent of our former slave masters and to move into freedom as we would choose. And the first people to sign up for that are those freedmen who are former soldiers. They're right there on the ground. So they say, wait, there's going to be land? Okay, sign me up. I'm going to do this land thing. That's very quickly revoked, unfortunately, with Circular 15. There's a series of letters in the Freedmen's Bureau records where freedmen are writing to Oliver O. Howard and to President Johnson and complaining about having Field Order 15 revoked. They are literally citing the Constitution. They'll say, as of this amendment, citizens have the right to be secure in their person. We have been assaulted. This is in violation of the law of the land. And it made me catch my breath when I first encountered it, because I thought, this is 1867. You've only been free for 2 years, and they have completely immersed themselves in the language and traditions of American citizenship and of the US Constitution. A reflection, I would say, of that argument between William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass, right, where Garrison says, the Constitution is a contract with Satan. We've got to tear it up and start over if we are ever going to move to freedom. And Douglass says, wait, hold on. Without that Bill of Rights, without the definitions of citizenship, what leg will the African American have to stand on? And it's very clear that freedmen took that very seriously.
And then speaking of the inclusion and exclusion, of course, we know that in the subsequent decades, there were purposeful attempts to exclude African Americans option to exercise the right to vote in the court of democracy.
Right. The ones that we are all familiar with, the poll tax, literacy test, grandfather clause, but also overt violence at polling places, both before and after ballots are cast. In the case of the poll tax, at least in Georgia, which is the state that I study, when the poll tax originally goes through in 1871, there are actually black legislators involved in that process. And they are agreeing for a tax on themselves, a head tax, as part of paying for education for black children in Georgia. What they don't anticipate is that 6 years later in 1877, that the state of Georgia will make that poll tax payment cumulative. So not that if you've just missed one, you can still vote, but if you haven't paid your poll tax in the previous 12 years, then you cannot vote, and you'd have to have that money all at once. And for people who are cash poor, of course, that's a barrier. That also affects whites, but whites are allowed to have a sort of good conduct clause escape hatch. Similarly, the literacy tests are not just about literacy. It's not just about, can you read and write in English? Literacy tests could be in Latin. There's an understanding clause, right? You pull out an obscure section of a legal document. Can you tell me what this means, right? The grandfather clause, which always makes me smile, because the grandfather clause simply says, you cannot vote unless your grandfather could have voted. Well, there's lots of folks who are biracial for whom their grandfathers could have voted. But somehow that didn't work out to their favor. And then there's the overt violence. And this is the part that is, for me, most damning to this idea of democracy. If I think about the Founding Fathers being very worried about the masses and the rabble, the people who attack folks in Louisiana and South Carolina and Georgia are a mob. They are organized as the Knights of the Knights, the Knights of the White Camellia or the Ku Klux Klan, but sometimes they're just ordinary white citizens who refuse to allow their now freed black brethren to participate in democracy. And unfortunately, those traditions will last from when they are instituted in the 1870s until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s.
And of course, we're seeing a repurposing of this mob language today.
Yes.
Right. As again, sort of a threat to democracy. I think these languages come back in circles and are used and exploited in various circumstances. I wanted to bring Paul into the conversation now. Because there's another large category of persons who were here even before we were, and who had systems of government even before our nation was formed. And that was a class of persons who for centuries was excluded from American democracy in all sorts of different ways. But I wonder maybe as a starting point, Paul, if you could sort of maybe talk a little bit about in one or two examples, maybe how did tribal and indigenous peoples who were here before this nation began and before we began our system of government, how did they envision government? Did they have ways by which they made decisions and convened to make decisions and pass laws and make rules, or was it a completely different type of expression?
That's a good question. Historians still debate whether the United States took some of its ideas of democracy from the Iroquois Confederacy. Certainly Ben Franklin, who had a lot of association with Iroquois leaders, found something of value in these different groups having consensus decision-making processes that maintain the peace over multiple generations. So the Iroquois is usually held up as sort of the most similar to the U.S. system. Other Indian nations had consensus-oriented decision-making, some of which included women. They were, in many cases, matriarchal societies that invested women with property, and so women had a lot of say over whether an Indian nation would go to war or not, for example. That was eroded in the famous Cherokee case where the Cherokee decided that in order to survive as Cherokee that they would have to adopt patriarchal decision making. So I think there's more common is a collection of chiefs, usually that would bring together representatives of different clans. So the concept of a nation really wasn't born until you get into the treaty making phase where nations had to nominate a delegate to negotiate with the federal officials. So a lot of it is representing the interests of clans in questions of resource and migration and so forth. But consensus was at the heart of a lot of political decision making. They would go on for days until everybody was in agreement. Mm-hmm. And that kind of piece. And that really brought together disparate groups of families and so forth. So, and then again with the Cherokee case where some Indian nations decided that the best course was to become a mirror of the American nation and adopt a constitution, which the Cherokee did in 1827. The Cherokee, of course, had slaves and denied voting rights to Cherokee who didn't have property. So that was another sort of corrosive impact of adopting the American system. And then I think when we get into the period of the Indian Wars, a lot of those consensus decision-making processes became eroded because of the pressure that U.S. officials put on Indian tribes, to migrate to a more conciliatory position that concentrated power in a small number of chiefs.
Was any of these adoptions of sort of American style of governance, were these a sort of added necessity always, or was there any element of it that had some utility for Native tribes?
Such as the Cherokee?
Yeah.
I hate to keep bringing up the Cherokee, because in some ways the Cherokee were an anomaly in the 19th century. The utility was for the Cherokee that they could remain Cherokee. They could become, in a sense, a nation within a nation. And that was, that was the context for the Supreme Court decision to grant their nation within a nation status. It was a practical decision, but it was also the result of class stratification that emerged in the Cherokee nation. Those who had slaves and were productive, the Cherokee were removed not because they failed, but because they were so successful in developing those agricultural lands and producing the kind of cotton they did. You have mansions in Cherokee, in the Cherokee Nation. So it really reflected the growth of a political elite that then used these instruments, such as a constitution, to deny suffrage to members of the Cherokee Nation, including slaves.
Right. And from your writing research, too, I was interested in this notion of indigenous peoples as sort of being their own nations throughout much of American history and not being integrated into the fabric of American society until very late. And in particular, I think they were excluded particularly from the 14th Amendment, which in the Constitution, which singled them out. So do they, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, but also when it comes to sort of democratic governance, do they see any optimism, any potential relief through American democratic structures, or because they've been kept so separated and excluded in so many different ways, do they not see any chance for redress of grievances through the American democratic process?
So in 1924, Congress adopts the Indian Citizenship Act, which grants U.S. citizenship to all Native people, whether they wanted it or not, and many didn't, because they didn't want to be a part of a nation that had treated them the way that they had. But a small elite, the Society of American Indians, was the first generation, the first graduates of the federal boarding school systems, and they understood very clearly that without any kind of legal protection, Native people would be vulnerable to the kind of predations that dominated in the American West in the 19th century and continued into the 20th century just because of new demographic pressures, new demands for lands, and so forth. And so there was a movement among people like Gertrude Bonin, Carlos Montezuma, to get the right to vote, to make Native people more integrated into the American system, especially in states where Native people had significant presence, Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and so forth. But those were a minority. Most Native people in the 1910s and 1920s were focused on reconstructing their nations out of the trauma of the Indian Wars and the reservation system that systematically deprived them of natural resources, water, gas, and so forth. So what you have then is a period that I see in the 1920s and 1930s where Native people are focused on reconstructing their own government. They're less attentive to external political issues. It really isn't until World War II where you see Native people really paying attention to the national political scene, partly because those tribal governments have become fairly well established, they've adopted constitutions in the 1930s, and people can start looking out into the broader political scene for various reasons, one of which is that Native people are very patriotic. They ironically are willing to die and defend the United States in the hopes that the country lives up to the ideals of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and also the treaties that Native people continue to believe are living instruments. So you have people serving in Europe in the 1940s and World War II. A lot of you, I'm sure, have seen the photo of the Iwo Jima, the raising of the flag in Iwo Jima. Right? There's one person who is not actually touching the flag in putting up the flag on the island, and that's Ira Hayes, who is a Pima Indian from Arizona, and it's symbolic of the fact that he's fighting in the name of freedom and democracy overseas, but when he comes home to Arizona, he can't vote. And so what you have is a generation of these native people who become politicized by the fact that they haven't, or you have people on reservations who have lost a son or a father who can't vote. So that's when I think you see them looking out into the national scene and also becoming clear that the federal government continues to have great control over reservation life and resources, and they have to start to represent their interests as a block, as a group, as an ethnic group of Indians, because all Indians are facing pressure.
Right. And I think, if I can categorize some of your work, I think your scholarship in particular looks at this sort of wrestling with loyalty and service to both the United States and to a particular Indian nation that a person may still belong to. It's sort of this sort of split duality that they sort of inhabit.
Yeah, I call it a hybrid patriotism. They're serving the country. The title of the book is serving their country. They're serving the United States. It's like double V campaign. You're fighting overseas in the name of democracy. Get the democracy at home. Well, what emerges, and this is really the subject of my new books, I don't have a lot of context, but this is an idea of dual citizenship. That, you know, in order to maintain the integrity and the sovereignty of Indian nations, Indian people have to become more active as U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. So it's a strategic thing, and again, Native people are also very deeply patriotic. At some point, they become invested in the notion of an America that upholds minority rights.
And that's a good segue into Jonathan and some of your work that you cover and your writing and reporting, because we are still having issues getting everyone access to the vote and access to the ballot. And some of your work and reporting has uncovered things that are local in nature but are happening in broader context across the country.
Yeah, it's kind of funny when Joanne was talking about Founding Fathers being concerned about democracy, meaning everyone participating and too many hands being involved and white men of means. Well, if they took a look at what would happen, it turns out that, and yeah, in fact, that's not quite the problem that we might have expected, because it turns out that turnout is really uneven, turnout can be low, and we have all sorts of design problems built into the way that right now. Things that I've been looking at in the past couple of weeks include what are called UOCAVA voters. These are military and civilian voters overseas. Well, starting in 2016, the Pennsylvania Department of State, concerned about foreign interference, said we need to block overseas access to our website. And that maybe on the surface level sounds like, hey, that's a security measure. We are going to stop overseas access. People can't get into our system. Well, what that means is that several thousand voters who live overseas can't access their ballots right now. And so I've been writing about that. I've been hearing from voter after voter who are telling me, why can't I get my ballot? Is something wrong? And they worry, and this is a real concern for me, they worry that it's intentional. Because historically, it has been intentional when these issues pop up. And sometimes today, it seems like it might still be intentional. And so people, I always get this question every time I'm writing about a different issue. People are asking me, you know, is this voter suppression? Are they trying to keep me from voting because they don't think that if I live overseas, I'm not allowed to vote, for example? Or, you know, we have some absentee ballot issues in terms of, in Pennsylvania, the law is very, very restrictive in terms of who is allowed to vote absentee. And we don't have early voting. And so most people in Pennsylvania vote on election day at the polls. in recent years, there has been a real shift across the country. And so many other states, you have early voting, you have what's called no excuse absentee voting, or vote by mail, in which you receive your ballot by mail and you can send it in, or you can go to a post office, or you can go to an election center, stuff like that, you can drop it off. Every year, every election, the number of people who are voting in some way other than on election day at the polls increases. In 2016, the general election in November 2016, 60% of the votes that came in on election day at the polls. 40% of voters voted in some other method, whether it's early or it's mail-in voting. 16 states had a majority of their votes cast in some other way than at the polls on election day. In the state of Pennsylvania, in this Commonwealth, in 2016, 95% of votes were cast at the polls on election day. Because so few people under our system right now are allowed to cast a vote in some other way. And so there's also politics involved with any attempt to change that system, and there are a lot of concerns on one side or the other side. But yeah, there are real problems right now with both who has the ability to cast a vote, and then even for those people who do, are they being mobilized and actually turning out to vote? And then there's also real concerns for me that people believe that they are intentionally being cast for voting.
And you've also looked at issues of gerrymandering. And we know that's the hot topic in this particular election, and has been for a while now. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of your reporting and what you found on that.
Sure. So Pennsylvania has a new congressional map. The one that was drawn up in 2011 gave, out of 18 congressional seats in every single election, 13 of them went to Republicans, 5 went to Democrats. Pennsylvania, of course, real battleground state. All the statewide votes are 50-50, pretty close. Right? We vote for Obama, and then we vote for Trump, right? 13-5, election after election. So last year, the League of Women Voters and a group of plaintiffs sued over that map. State lawsuit, not a federal lawsuit, went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned the map. They gave the opportunity to draw a new one. That didn't happen, in part because that requires the Republican-controlled General Assembly to get a map that the Democratic Governor Wolf would approve, and that didn't happen. And so the Pennsylvania Supreme Court drew up its own map with the help of a special master, and we have a new congressional map that those of you who are registered to vote in Pennsylvania will be voting in next week. As of right now, of course, we're still in the, toward the end of a term, and so that the old map still lives on right now. In fact, we're going to have 2 special elections to fill 2 seats under the old map to fill out the rest of that term. But we do have a new congressional map coming in. And, partisan gerrymandering has received a lot of attention, in part, I think, because it used to be one of these things that seemed very arcane. People were like, oh, yeah, maybe, like, I remember that in, middle school. Like, I learned something about redistricting, something about the census. But as people have become more politically engaged and civically engaged, and people have been learning about this, and there's been sort of this movement in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and a few other states to really bring this to people as like a real grassroots effort. For people who think that the map is unfair and that the politicians shouldn't be drawing the map or drawing the map in their own favor in such a way, it seems really shocking to them when they say, oh, Pennsylvania, yeah, 50-50 state, 13-5. Election after election.
Right. Well, I think this is all really useful in sort of getting some issues on the table that I hope we can now sort of discuss amongst ourselves and bring you in for discussion. One of the things that strikes me, Joanne, is that we've moved very far away from the original vision of democracy that some of the early founders envisioned, and we haven't even yet touched on the idea of women's suffrage, which I know we need to cover and make sure we have discussion on. But was this the kind of democracy that was envisioned, one that includes women and African Americans and Native Americans and Asian Americans and Latino Americans and other hyphenated Americans? Or would, do you think the founders would look at this and say, this is appalling? This is exactly what we warned you against in all of our Federalist Papers?
Well, you know, so the short answer to that is they would not have imagined this. You know, every now and again, someone would say, usually, you know, think Albert Gallatin asks Jefferson, like, what do you think about women holding positions of office? Women's having the vote. And, you know, Jefferson is like, so it wasn't on the radar. Now, interestingly, I will say, sort of related to what Allison was saying, there was a brief moment when in New Jersey women had the vote. And there was a, so the revolution is kind of seen as this moment that's an opening moment in which people had a sense of real engagement in creating this new country. And so there's a sense of a door opening, and that door is closed gradually over time, and the same thing happened for women. But I think, you know, if the founders were here now and sort of gazing at our current form of democracy, the thing they talked about again and again and again, and this was true not just for the sort of more aristocratic Hamiltons of the world, but they looked back and they looked at democratic city-states of various sorts in the past, and this has to do again with their not quite trusting the masses. To them, the major threat and the thing you had to guard against was a demagogue. That's what destroys republics. Again and again and again, it's throughout. It's the Federalist essays, it's repeatedly. It's like the worst thing you could say about somebody in a campaign was to sort of point at that and say, that person, that's a dangerous person, that's a demagogue, because that kind of person can manipulate the vulnerability in the system. And I wish I could recreate Howells's words. At one point he says, you know, if I wanted to make trouble, let me tell you what I would do. I would get everybody all emotionally worked up about everything. I would ride the fury of their emotions right into office, and then I would do whatever I wanted to do. That's the core of vulnerability, is emotion and unpredictability, and, you know, the things that on the one hand open our system and are, make it responsive to our will and demands, also are a vulnerability depending on who's in power or who wants power. So that would be, right now, you know, what I think about is Hamilton, who maybe that's the most frequent word, energy in government and demagogue, or maybe the two most frequent things that he talks about.
Right, well, and of course, those are defining features of American politics today, for sure. I wonder, I mean, there's so much rhetoric now about, you know, democracy dies in darkness, and everything that comes out is a great threat to democracy. I think in one of your articles, Jonathan, you mentioned that the League of Women Voters in their lawsuit against the gerrymandering map said that this is one of the greatest threats to American democracy, right? That was one of their quotes. I guess on some level, which democracy is it a threat to? Are these measures a threat to the utopian vision of democracy that we envision, where everyone is included and there's no issues, or is this, you know, is that, we've never actually realized that vision, I guess, is part of it. And so is it a threat to that idealistic vision of democracy? Is this just rhetoric that people use because it's a threat to their particular political party?
Hard to say, if you ask them, and you should, they might say to you, oh, no, of course, it's not a nonpartisan question, and we're just talking about, you know, real democracy, whatever that might mean to whoever's saying it. Then you have people on the other side who will say, you know, well, they're just Democrats, and I've heard all sorts of things, especially with the gerrymandering case, where it was brought by the League of Women Voters, and they're a nonpartisan organization. But the Republican lawmakers that I talked to were all saying, well, they're just Democrats. They just want Democrats to win, right? When I think about this question of, like, which democracy are they talking about, and what is the way that they want it to work, honestly, I break it down and I think about it like any other policy issue, and I say, well, they're talking about, like, who's allowed to vote, if you do use your constitutional right to petition the government for redress of grievances, is somebody listening? How does that turn out? I think of these as policy issues. And if you break them down into policy issues, then it becomes a fairly straightforward question to say, are different groups able to express those their policy preferences? Are you able to go to the polls and vote for the people that you want? Are you able to have your vote counted the right way? Are you able to bring out other people who would be eligible to vote? And so, to me, it almost, I don't know how many different competing visions of democracy there are out there, and I don't know how many, you know, how much support each one has. What I'm concerned with is, given those visions of democracy, given those numbers, are they all being expressed? Are they all able to be expressed if the people who hold them want to do so?
Although I have to say, contemporarily, paying very close attention, because I work on Georgia, and because I work on Georgia in another reactive moment, that one of the candidates in Georgia has made it very, very clear that he is looking for not a utopian vision of democracy. In fact, that his fear is that everyone who can vote actually will, right? And so this suggests that not only was the decision to try to gut the Voting Rights Act, not a good idea, but that yet again, 150 years later, African Americans are on the brink of being right where they were before, which is denied their basic civil rights and having a voice in the body politic.
And I think it's, you know, it's hard to have these conversations without history, right? So I think history and historical perspectives help us see things through a different lens and helps us understand where things that may be just below the surface that we don't automatically pick up on, maybe calling back to earlier time periods, even with their language or with their actions, and history can help us perhaps guard against areas where we see certain rights being eroded or where democracy may in fact be in peril. Would you agree?
Yes, I would, and the challenge is multi-layered for me, right? So I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that most of us in this room remember a moment when you either had high school history in 9th or 10th grade or you had civics, so that you actually learned the three parts of government, your responsibilities as a citizen, what the Supreme Court did, what Congress did, the roles of the president. I now work with young people between the ages of 18 and 22, many of whom have never had that conversation, right? And so it's not just teaching them the history of what people struggled to get access to democracy was, but what the grand experiment of democracy is, period, right? So if you don't know what democracy is or was envisioned to be, how can you be mindful of it being eroded underneath your feet?
And I want to add to that, because Allison and Paul, you were both talking about groups of people who were grabbing at the Constitution, the written Constitution, as their way to get those rights. And now, Allison, what you're talking about is people who don't have that knowledge, right? So they don't have that lever to grab at, and no sense, you know, Americans, all the way back to colonial America, were a very paper constitution-minded people. They came as colonists, they wanted to know their rights, they wanted them to be on a piece of paper, and that's been true marching all along. But we are at an interesting moment where, and again, it sort of feels very glib to say, like, oh, we don't teach civics anymore. So, but still, the fact that people fundamentally don't understand the very things that different populations of people knew.
Yes.
We're there. Now, of course, kind of related to what you're saying, Jason, right there you're talking about at least two levels of democracy. You're talking about the ideal that in some way or another is captured in a constitution, and then you're talking about what everyone here has been talking about, which is the reality in which people find all kinds of ways to not quite violate the constitution, or maybe even to violate the constitution, but to do it in a way that people aren't willing to respond to.
Do you want to add anything?
Just that for Native Americans, they do, having, and I spent part of my summer looking through newspapers, Indian newspapers, and a lot of it was
how to educate people on the fact that they have that right to vote, what's at stake for them. And so there's an education process. And for Native people, some of whom are in very remote parts of the country, the physical act of voting becomes really difficult. And there's been some recent cases of voter suppression, North Dakota case in particular, which speaks to the fact that when Native people can vote together, they have an impact. They helped get Heidi Heitkamp elected in 2012, which is when North Dakota Republicans initiated their effort to strip Native people of their right. But for Native people, there's also the treaties, which is a document that a lot of them pay attention to. So part of why they're voting is to maintain, is to make sure that the United States maintains its diplomatic international law agreements with these Indian nations in the form of these treaties. So the paper does matter. In many cases, Native people would have the treaty in their back pocket. So when people tried to suppress their rights to hunt and fish, they would bring it out of their pocket and say, this is the document. Mm-hmm. So it's that belief in the paper, the law, really, that motivates Native people, I think.
Yeah. And I did pull out a copy of this book, which I had been reading recently, not to make too much of a plug for it, because it's actually written by a person at Harvard Business School, so his history chapter, perhaps a bit questionable. But it is a democracy, a case study, but the reason I brought it out is because I wanted to use it as a source, because in the conclusion to the book, he pulls out a couple of quotes that I wanted to share. The first was, "The great American Republic has of late been traveling fast in the broad road to despotism and ruin." That's from the Connecticut Current in 1810. "It has become somewhat of a commonplace assertion that politics in the United States have reached the lowest stage to which they may safely go. No democracy can hope to withstand the corrupting influences now at work in our midst unless certain radical reforms are carried to a successful conclusion." That's a book by William D. McCracken, written in 1892. And then the quip from John Kenneth Galbraith in the mid-20th century that says, "Every publisher wants his author's book to be entitled The Crisis in American Democracy because he knows that title will sell." I bring that up because it's obvious that in other contexts, in other American contexts, democracy has been seen to be imperiled and at risk of failure. And of course, I think we're living through moments like that again, although for different reasons. But I guess I wanted to get on some perspective from our panelists about whether this sort of constant vigilance or constant paranoia about the state of democracy is somehow embedded within the American democratic experiment itself.
Can you still hear me?
Yes.
You're great. Seems ominous. I would say that among the founder folk, skepticism and vigilance was part of what they assumed was necessary in a republic. Jefferson was a big proponent of education because he thought, well, most Americans should have at least a minimal, because white male Americans should have at least a minimal amount of education so they can recognize a threat to the republic. They should understand history and they should understand what happens to republics so that they'll recognize threats and be able to stand up against them. So I think there was always an assumption that skepticism, vigilance were what a republic really relied on more than anything else.
Yeah, I was going to simply say that I agree. The old saw the price of freedom as vigilance, right? And for the 1892 quote, the heart of the Gilded Age, what Richard White refers to as the most corrupt era in American history, he wasn't wrong.
I think most of the people in this room probably are politically engaged, probably read some degree of news and try to vote if you can, and try to make sure other people vote as well, but that's really rare. And one thing that I think is really important to remember is that there are a lot of people who aren't interested in participating. Beyond those who are interested and can participate, one of the things with a lot of these voter reforms that I was talking about with like early voting and stuff, it's not clear yet that those actually change turnout very much. In many cases, it just shifts when people vote. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that some small percentage of people that were not going to be able to vote can vote. But in a lot of cases, it's a convenience reform. And one of the things that I find really fascinating is when you go and talk to people, a lot of people aren't going to vote. And I know that for a lot of us, it's like, I'm on Twitter and I'm like, oh man, everyone in my mentions is, you know, always yelling at me about Trump this and, you know, Clinton that and Governor Wolf. And it's like, great, there are people who are really, really engaged right now. But I'm sorry, but when a third of registered Philadelphians didn't vote in November 2016, and there are many more Philadelphians who didn't register in the first place, one of the saddest reasons that I sometimes hear is the people who are worried about jury duty or something, and so that sometimes concerns me. There are people who choose not to vote, and in some cases, they don't think that their vote matters anyway. They don't think that even if they were to vote, even if their vote could make a numeric difference, mm-hmm. that it matters who you put into office. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there are all these different concerns about the state, you know, who's going to represent what and what that person is going to do and what the policy issues are. But I'm also just really concerned about people not engaging, even if we give them the right and clear the barriers to vote and to talk to their representatives and their lawmakers, are they going to do it, or are they so disenchanted and disaffected with the process that they choose not to do so, or they feel like it doesn't matter what they do?
So how can historical perspective help? You know, we've obviously timed this conversation to coincide with the midterm elections, which are coming up, and as you said, most people in this room are probably civically engaged, but we all may have neighbors who are not, and it's easy to be disillusioned by the headlines and you see coming out of Washington. I lived there for 7 years. I got disillusioned. But does having historical perspective help? Does having a sort of broader understanding of this democratic experiment and this expansion of democracy from what it was originally conceived to how it's grown to be more inclusive and how change has been, albeit hard fought and hard won, how change has occurred through the use of a democratic process? Does that help? Can that offer some solution to some of these concerns? Or does it matter at all?
So as someone who spent her life as a historian, I have to believe that that matters. Because otherwise, what have I been doing with my time? And certainly as a I have two biases here. I'm a working class African American woman, right? So I might have a PhD and tenure now, but that is not the arc of my life. That's just where I got to. And my father was career military. My brother is career military. My son, who is in the Coast Guard, despite that Boston College education, looks like he's going to be career military. So that means that I have like a big patriot Captain America A tattooed on my forehead. So my conversation is always historically rooted, but it is also always speaking to the experience of Black people in America. That part of our struggle was to push the nation to an actually more democratic space. And that people literally gave up their lives so that the rest of us could walk free and take advantage of the right to vote. And I do sort of club people with it, right? That people literally died for you to have this opportunity. I also try very hard to remind young people, as Michelle Obama said beautifully, you would not want your grandmother or your uncle to pick what music you listen to, what clothes you wear, what movies you watch. Why do you want to give up the power to let them decide the rest of the dynamics of your life? This is your voice, right? So I tend to be a bit of a curmudgeon about democracy and the vote, because I think it has been, for all of the suffering, all of the pain, all of the loss, all of the lynching, all of the looting, all of the burning, Black people have moved this country forward in a positive way, and I'm sort of willing to stand on that hill and die on that hill.
Paul, did you?
Yeah, I attended I just came from a conference on the Navajo Nation, a celebration of a treaty, the 1868 treaty. And the Dene people, the Navajo, pay a lot of attention to that treaty, again, because of the value of the treaty and preserving their sovereignty. And I was on a panel with a lawyer, and a lot of the Native, a lot of the Navajo that were attending my presentation, I had the privilege of going into the archives, and looking at documents, and the time, the sabbatical or whatever, to make sense of it and to produce. And I think that they, sometimes people don't have the time to do that. They need people, they need professional historians, amateur historians, people who believe in history as an enterprise, to give them some context for their own decision making. And I always fall back on is, we have come a long way. That's the product of millions of people going into the street or going into the ballot box. You know, talking about urban day pollution and things like that. You and I talked about how we have to remember what that struggle was, and so we have to document that struggle. We have to create stories of that struggle that speaks to people's everyday experiences. So I think you just have to keep engaging the public in ways that they can relate.
I think also that the long arc of history, having that historical perspective, first of all, thank you very much, Allison, for saying that, because I feel the same way. Of course it has to count. It's history. But I think that long perspective, you know, I think that there's a temptation to assume that the arc of history is always for the better, right? We're always getting better. Everything's always rising. And I think that when you do have a historical perspective, what you see is negotiation, struggle, rights taken away, and then fought for to get them back. You see that there's nothing predetermined or inevitable about our political system. You see, you restore the humanity to it, and you see that democracy, yes, it's a, you know, in a sense, it's an ism, and it sort of floats up here. You know, we love democracy. Democracy is good, but in reality, it's on the ground, it's us. And that's the way it either will or won't survive. And I think that only a really grounded in people, kind of as you're suggesting too, Paul, historical perspective that really shows you that human process of figuring out what it is and then fighting for what you want it to be. That, I think, at least brings to life at any moment, not just our current moment, what the stakes are.
And that's might be a way to sum up American democracy, at least the American democratic concern, is that people are fighting for what they believe. And to make it just slightly better than those who came before.